or Mr. Baker, would you like to tell us about your early childhood days when you were growing up in the Aberdeen area?
Well, yes, I'll be glad to. I was born in Baltimore, but have spent all my life in Aberdeen, except for a few years at college and a little over 4 years during World War II. I guess what brings to mind, or what I think of first, is how small the town was. There were only about 600 people in Aberdeen. When I went downtown, it was strange to see someone that I didn't know. Now it's strange to see someone that I do know. Everybody's, many of the people are newcomers to Aberdeen, and I think that's what has changed the town, as many other towns in the local area, as much as anything in my mind. I went to the Aberdeen schools, graduated in 1938, and as I say, many things have changed, mostly the people.
Or can you maybe tell us about some of your childhood activities, such as what you did in your free time, or what extra school activities they had then?
Well, we had most of the sports, all except football. That was considered to be kind of dangerous, and a lot of the people, especially in Harford County, I guess, objected to games that where kids could get hurt. But we didn't have, of course, television, and a lot of people, I guess, didn't have radios, but we tended to make our own fun. We had a lot of sort of get-togethers. Two or three or four or five people or whatever would get together with a couple dozen marshmallows and go down and build a fire along the beach at Forest Greens, and we would sit around a campfire and sing songs and have a good time just that way. Or we'd go to one of our homes and have dances. Most of us had a Victrola and a few records. But there seemed to be an effort among the group of people that I went with to make our own fun together and to enjoy do our own thing, so to speak. If anybody had 35 cents or 40 cents or 50 cents to put 2 or 3 gallons of gas in the car, would make our evening for us. I can remember. None of us had very much money either. We would sometimes go down to the name of the place slips my mind, but we would go down, 3 or 4 or 5 of us, and buy a can of Hershey syrup and go to the ice cream store and get a dish of ice cream and put our own syrup on it. It seemed to be a way to get a sundae without having to pay the full price. But we did it together. There were a lot of things that we did. We didn't. There just weren't places to go where you could be entertained. You had to do your own entertaining.
Or would you like to tell us about your home life, like the things you did at home, or your parents, or brothers and sisters that you've had?
Well, I was one of three boys. I'm the eldest of three. My youngest brother died a couple of years ago. But we lived in along Bel Air Avenue in a large house there. At that time, next to the B&O property. And part of our yard is where Curtis Morgan lives now. And there was about 20 acres in that plot of ground. We had horses when I was very young, and a big lawn to mow, and a lot of upkeep not only on our home, but a lot of the outbuildings. We had a shop, we had a woodshed, we had a large barn. And there were many things that we had, a large garden too. And there was a great deal to do at home. And I spent a lot of time there doing the chores that should have been done, and helping my father. And the bakers were all canners. My father was a member of the family that that did a great deal of commercial canning in the county. My father carried that over into his regular, into his home life, and a lot of the things that he had in his garden he liked to can. So I guess many nights when people were out doing other things, I was in the kitchen helping my father put up beans or cherries or making ginger ale or root beer, and we always had our large pantry full of the things that that were made so that we could consume them in the winter time. There was a lot of music in my home. My father played the cello, and I learned to play the piano. I went to Peabody for a couple of years, and I helped him. I played his accompaniment. And so I got a musical education that way, not only formally, but playing with my father. There were no cards in the house, although my father liked to play pinochle. I didn't play any cards. We children were not encouraged to play cards. I guess most of what I did at home was to help out. Do you think of anything I ought to add to that?
Well, I must have learned anything in your younger days. You were a railroad general training.
Oh, yeah, I was a great enthusiast for trains. I had a Lionel set. And again, it was a matter of seeking out friends who had the same interests. And we would trade trains and transformers and try to work up new ideas, rheostats and so on, in making, not only putting cranes together, but Christmas gardens. Was kind of the ultimate way of displaying what we did. Charles Worsing was, I guess, my prime buddy in trains at one time, and the Christmas gardens would be kept up just as long as the parents would let us. And sometimes they extended into February, March, or April, even if the parents would let us. Train platforms, as we made them then, were about a foot and a half off of the floor and generally occupied as much as a half or a third of a pretty good-sized room. Maybe not a half, but a third. I was not too much involved in team sports. Our folks had a winter home in Florida, and along about late October, early November, we would go to Florida for the winter and come back in April or maybe March, so that my father could go to his canning house and begin to get the machinery and things in readiness for the season, also to arrange for planting his corn. In summertime, I was very much involved in the canning house. He was grooming me to take over the business, I suppose. He started me in one end of the canning house, and I actually went out in the fields to learn how to know when the corn was ready for pulling, and then I spent a summer hauling husk and putting the corn in the chutes, and then another summer in the husking shed, and then a summer or two where they were cutting corn, and another summer where they were cooking it or putting it in the cans, and then another time in the warehouse, so that I knew the entire a procedure for canning corn, thinking that someday I would be doing that course, my father lost his business in 1938 or 9 when they had the bad years. He never really did recover from the crash of 1929. So he lost his factory and all of his stuff. Lost about everything except his home. And we had that up until just a few years ago.
Or could you just tell us about the process that you went through preparing the corn and then through the whole canning process that you've known from then?
Well, a good deal of the work, as in other industries, was done by hand that now is done by machine. The corn, of course, was pulled when my father or one of us indicated that it was ripe. My father had furnished the seed to the farmers so that he could ensure that the quality of corn that he got was the best. He couldn't leave it up to the farmers to buy their own seed. So he bought it, gave it to them early in the season, and they planted it, and when it was ready, why, we would tell them that it was time to pull. Although my father had his own crew for pulling in later years, that way he not only could tell the farmers what kind of seed to plant, but he also could pull it just when he wanted. Farmers kind of liked to let it stay in the fields another 2 or 3 days till it got older and therefore was heavier and they could sell it for more money. They sold it for whatever it weighed. And incidentally, I spent a couple summers on the scales weighing the corn when it came in. Husking was done by machines beginning in the the early 1930s. But my father always had a lot of people from the town of Middletown, and he had his factory over in Delaware to escape the competition from his brothers and others here around Aberdeen that were doing a lot of canning. And outside of the factory, there would be a big shed where people in the town would husk corn by hand when he needed it. Another thing that I did then was to punch the tickets when they filled their baskets with husked corn. I would punch their ticket before they put it on the conveyor belt that took it past the ladies who looked it over and made sure that there were no worms on it, and had all the husk, and they cut out the bad places. So the corn was pulled, put into the husking machines or husked by hand, and then on a conveyor belt where it was cleaned by the ladies, and then it was washed before it went into another conveyor that dropped it in front of about 40 or 45 women who were corn cutters. They cut the corn off the cob, and they got, at my time of being there, they got 5 cents a bucket for cutting the corn off the cob. And then when the corn was full, there was a man, when the bucket was full, there was a man there to take the corn and put it into a machine that washed it again. And then there was another machine that, after it was washed, put the corn in the can. And then there was a capping machine that put the caps on. The corn then was conveyed to a platform in which there were 8 large kettles that were heated by steam. And they were cooked for a certain, I've forgotten the amount of time that was involved, but they were cooked under steam pressure and then sent to the warehouse to cool. The warehouse was another large area where the labeling, where the cooling was done, the labeling was done, and then the cans were put into boxes and stored. My father generally canned between 40 and 60,000 cases of corn. And then he had another factory in the same town where he canned tomatoes. And he also canned peas. But he stopped canning peas and tomatoes along about 1928 when he found that they didn't bring in the price that corn did. And a lot of the labor, and I think this is an interesting part, was brought in from the Patterson Park area of Baltimore, which was a strong Polish community. And every year, certain families like the Pocsik, P-O-C-S-I-K family, the entire family worked for my father, and they, along with the other Polish families, would come in to Middletown by truck. My father always sent a truck. Sometimes it was just an open truck, had to wait for good weather. And in fact, I used to drive the truck into Patterson Park and load up these Polish workers with a few of their belongings in a suitcase and bring them to Middletown. My father had a long shed in which there were rooms and a place for bed where my father had gotten straw in to serve as mattresses for the people. They would come over a week or so before canning season. The Pocsik family would have come early so they could help get the machinery in readiness. And I remember playing with these Polish children and getting such a pleasure out of seeing them come back every year. And they had the best bread. They made their own ovens there. My father would get the wood for them that they needed. And I can remember eating that bread. Now, we somewhat irreverently called it Bohic bread. But it was good, and I can't remember ever having tasted anything that's any better. But they kept themselves pretty much in the Middletown area. They stayed around their so-called shacks. But they were happy people, and people, as I say, that I enjoyed being with. Now, for the rest of us, my father and the crew of mechanics and others that he had, we always lived in a place called the shanty. And the shanty was a place with three rooms. There was a kitchen and a big open dining room with a long table, and upstairs was a dormitory. And each one of us had a cot with a mosquito net over it. And we would move over there in the early part of the summer. I would go over as soon as school was out, help my father and the one or two people that he had then to get the factory in readiness. And then, as the time grew close to canning, why, he would bring over three or four other people who lived in Havre de Grace and Bel Air, and one or two from the Eastern Shore, and I can't remember just what towns they were from. But it was pretty much a community in itself. Townspeople worked in the factory, but my father had his own crew that he had known for years and that he always wanted back when they would come. That factory still stands over there. It looks pretty disreputable since the people using it have just used it for an occasional storage area, but most of the buildings are pretty much in ruin.
Would you like to tell us about what you were doing during the different schools in Aberdeen, like, I guess, the grammar school through high school, what they were like?
Well, grammar school was right down on Route 40, and the high school was right next to it. And I think around 1937 or 36, they built a building between the two that joined them. If you look at those two schools now, which is a community center, you'll note that there are two separate buildings that have obviously been joined. And the front of the building is the auditorium, and that served to link the two together. But in between was an area that was barren of any grass. It just had stones in between, and that was a great place for the marble games. The kids, when I was going to school, played marbles. And we couldn't wait to get out to do one of two things. Well, several things, I guess. One was to play marbles, which I was never very good at. Another was to use the swings. There was several sets of swings, which I liked to get on. And people would get out early so they could get a swing and hopefully hold it for all of recess. Or grab two swings if you could and save one for a friend. And then those who liked baseball and some of the other sports. I did go out for track and fared pretty well with track. But as I mentioned, I spent my winters in Florida, so and it just seemed like the time I got back from Florida, the fellows that were already here had pretty well gotten started in the baseball. And there weren't very many fall sports. I forgot to mention, too, there was no basketball either when I was there. That didn't come along until about 1942, 1943. And I guess that's about all I can remember of school. There weren't very many in our class. We had about, we graduated with, I think, 32 in the class. And since that was split between academic and commercial people, it meant that our academic class was pretty small. I couldn't tell you the number. It's amazing the number of fellows that are and people, number of people that are still around Aberdeen from my class. I enjoy the company of several of them still. I think more from our class stayed around than most of the other classes. I was very fond of all the teachers I had. The principal was old Pop Stevens. He didn't like to be called Pop. But he was just a real nice guy. I don't know how much he knew about education. He was a lawyer, but anyway, he was a principal. I know I was very fond of him. I made the mistake of calling him Pop one time when he heard me, and he got after me for calling him Pop. One of his ideas was to celebrate Christmas and the 4th of July with firecrackers. And he lived down the 4th of July, and I can remember being down there and hearing all of this racket. Learned that my principal was upstairs throwing firecrackers out of the window. I never could quite figure that out, but he was after being principal, he reverted to, went back to his law practice and had an office here in Aberdeen. A lot of wonderful teachers that I had. One of them was Miss Walker, who lived where Paradise Road intersects the road to Havre Grace, right close to Webster Village. And she taught all of the science. And then we had a Miss Hitchcock who taught all of the English and the Latin. And in elementary school we had a Mr. Price. He and his wife were both teachers. Mrs. Price later became principal of an elementary school here in Aberdeen. But, as I say, being in Florida half the time, I don't remember I guess as much about elementary school as I might have. High school. School was fun, as I look back on it. It was a real pleasure. We only had 11 grades. Every other school in the county had 12. We had only 11. And that didn't change until about 1949. I graduated in 38. It was 11 years later that they added a 12th year. I think I'm right about that. I'm not overly confident on that year.
You were saying that the Depression had hurt your canning industry, or what other ways did the Depression affect when you were growing up in that area of Aberdeen?
Well, my folks didn't have anything really but their house. I can remember that we ran up a good bill, food bill, at the store because my father simply couldn't pay it. We dealt at Adams' store, W.N. Adams and Son. A lot of us just didn't have any money. I know that we bought day-old bread. It was at least a day old. I know that we didn't have milk delivered. We couldn't afford it. That I used to go up to Krause's and with a pail and get 2 gallons of milk carried back home. Clothes were difficult to come by. I wore other children's clothes, and I'm sure a lot of others among my friends did the same thing. But it just wasn't any money. I see my children who go out and spend several dollars for things that I just simply couldn't afford. People didn't make any long distance phone calls. I can remember that. The car stayed in the garage for long periods of time because we were out walking instead of riding. And people just didn't have money to do what they needed. Now, my mother took in roomers in our house. We had a large house. We had 16 rooms in our house. As the proving ground began to grow and new people came in, my mother saw that as an opportunity to make some money and pay back the grocer. And so our house was, I think, every square inch that my mother could find, we had someone sleeping in it. And I have always admired her for getting busy and really doing something about paying off some of our debts. But we had 5 bedrooms on the third floor, and I can remember they're all being filled with people. And I remember one time when I came home from college, I went into my bedroom and there was somebody in there. My mother had not expected me home from college, but some guy had come to the door and needed a place to stay, and she rented my room. But I think that's an indication as to how tight things were. And it wasn't until the war came along, a lot of people came into town. And my father, who was unemployed as a result of having lost his business and got work on the proving ground, only then did things begin to come back to where we were a little more solvent. This hurt me somewhat in college. By the time I was ready to go to college, there wasn't any money at home to go. So I earned my way. It was difficult. I worked at the Bethlehem Steel plant. When I was in college, I did everything from babysitting to delivering coal to pounding a typewriter, whatever I could do to get the bills paid for in college. And other people did the same thing, and I was not different than most and many other people who had to work if they wanted to go. War came along, and I was away, and then came back with the GI Bill. It was a new law.
Have you ever heard of Baker Cemetery?
Oh, I think I've heard of it, yes.
Have your cautions run? I guess that would be considered Carson's Run, wouldn't it?
Okay.
Could you maybe tell us about Mr. C. Milton Wright that you happen to know, maybe some of his personality that you might remember?
I really didn't know him that well. But have you got that all now?
My
father used to tell about C. Milton Wright. I didn't know about him until he saw me one time and asked me if I was the son of Harold Baker. And I said, yes. He said, well, I know your family real well. I'd met him at some function when I was a teenager. And he began to tell me how he had come here to be, he was a teacher first before he became school superintendent. He needed a place to stay, and my grandfather was very anxious, always interested in the community. Interested in the community in every way. He planted the trees up along Bel Air Avenue, the maple trees there. He had a greenhouse in the back of his place, and he gave geraniums to all of the students when the school was out at the end of school. And he and his brothers gave the land on which our Methodist Church now stands. And they were very active, extremely active in the church. But anything relating to the community, particularly education and particularly the children, they did. So when a teacher needed, like Mr. Wright, needed a place to stay, they were their big house and they had servants. In fact, there are servants' quarters in that house still. They were anxious to oblige. So Mr. Wright stayed there until he found another place to go. I don't know how long he stayed there. But I do know he was extremely fond of my father and his family and always spoke very well of them. I didn't know him other than to speak to, although I'm an admirer of him for his book, I did get him to autograph my book and went up to Preston Stationery and store and got him to put a note in the front of the book, which I bought. But my family, very community, speaking of the community orientation, people in Aberdeen wanted a burial place. The only places to be buried were, I think, the Presbyterian Church Cemetery. And so my grandfather and his brothers cut off 2 acres of the farm and donated $6,000 and set up a little family possession, which which served as a burial place for anybody that wanted.
Put it back on the hook.
And I've had, when I came back from college in 1950, when I came back to Aberdeen in 1950, I became one of the officers of the cemetery, and I'm president now, and in the meantime we turned it over to the church, but they donated that land for the community. They also helped a lot of the poor families in the town. They had plenty of money, so it was good that they did, and they did very willingly, and they were unusual, I think, in that they didn't want anybody to know that they had donated certain food or certain things to people. But they did that all of their lives.
Are these your brothers you're talking about?
Talking about my grandfather and his brothers.
Oh, okay.
That were here at the time.
Would you like to tell us about what it was like, I guess, during your college years, some of the courses you had?
I went to Dickinson College because that's where my father went. And all he could talk about in his discussions around the table was how great it was to go to college, and he had been, and how great it was, and how I had to go. And he went up there with me and got me right into the college. He was a board of directors, on the board of directors where he served for 45 years. It was kind of funny as I think about it. He took me up there when he didn't have any money to give me, but he wanted me to go to college. And I entered owing the tuition and not having money really to get along on. He wanted me to join a fraternity because that's what he had done. And so I immediately went, pledged Kappa Sigma, and really had a wonderful 2 years at Dickinson College, but it was clouded somewhat by my not having the money to pay my bills. So I would go to college, run up my bills during the year, and then the day after college I would go to Bethlehem Steel Company in Sparrows Point, where I got very good wages of 69 cents an hour. And paid my bills by working in the summer, and then I would start over again in the fall. Finally, since tuition there was, it's a private college, was kind of heavy, I decided I would change to the University of Maryland. So I transferred to the University of Maryland, where I graduated after college, after the Army. I graduated here in 1938, spent 2 years at Dickinson College, and then I got into the, transferred to the University of Maryland, and after a semester there, the war broke out, and I took training here at Aberdeen, my basic. I went to non-commissioned officer school, took training there, and I went to the candidate school and graduated as a second lieutenant, and after teaching in the ordnance school for a little while, I was on my way to India, where I spent nearly 3 years in the India, Burma, and China theater of war. Our main mission there was to build a road into China so that we could supply the Chinese, who then were trying to drive the Japanese out of Southeast Asia. And I came back to the University of Maryland and finished my degree. It took me 9 years from the time I started to the time I got out. Jobs were easy to get then. I got a job right away at the Aberdeen Proving Ground as an education officer for the Proving Ground, and spent 25 years working in and around the headquarters of Aberdeen Proving Ground. I retired there in 1974, worked for a brief period with the state of Maryland and their Department of Social Services in Baltimore, and then retired from there in 1981, so I've been retired for 5 years. I also stayed in the reserve so that I retired at age 60 from the as a reservist. I achieved the rank of lieutenant colonel in the military, and I've stayed right here in the same house that I moved into in 1950 and where we have reared our 5 children.
Would you like to tell us maybe a little bit of detail what type of work you did for Aberdeen Proving Grounds?
Well, I was the first civilian education advisor for Aberdeen Proving Ground, and I stayed there for 8 years. This involved helping young military personnel achieve whatever education they needed for advancement in the service, or just to read and write. There were a lot of people who came into service during the Korean War that really didn't know how to read and write, so we had a basic education program for them. I know at one time we had about 300 of these men in school teaching them to read and write and how to figure a little bit, do a little bit of mathematics. But it was a civilian-type education on the installation, and it ranged from the first grade through college. There were a lot of officer personnel who at that time needed a college degree so that they could achieve a higher rank in the military. And we had a University of Maryland and University of Delaware program, and I was the contact on the installation for setting up and having a place for these people to go to give their classes and to go to school, and manage the tuition payments that the Army assisted the personnel with to encourage them to go farther. After 8 years in that one job, well, I became the director of that education center after a few years as its advisor. And that was about as far as I could go in the education area there, so I transferred or got a better job in the headquarters as a sort of a management analyst for the plans office and programmer for the plans office. That was in the office of the commander of the proving ground. And for 10 years, I was in the plans office. And that involved reviewing and budget and budgetary planning and programming for the support function of the Aberdeen Proving Ground. After that, about that time, a new job was opening up. They needed an equal opportunity officer for the Proving Ground. And having had a good deal of work in sociology and being very anxious for an advancement, as I guess most people are, I took the job as equal opportunity officer, and I served in that function for approximately 6.5 years. Now, equal opportunity, as most people know, is a program that attempts to help minorities and females achieve an equal chance for promotion and for fair treatment on the workforce. This meant setting up rather extensive grievance procedures and following through on grievances and setting up programs that would help and training programs, did a great deal of training, tried to get supervisors and others to realize the importance of treating everybody equally. And that was fine, and I learned a great deal. After a while, it became rather clouded with the function of unions and other people who were trying to achieve the spotlight. They weren't interested, in my judgment, in equal opportunity. They wanted either unequal opportunity for whatever factions they were working for. And I found that it was rather difficult to render justice when there was such a plethora of individual desires and a lot of angling for important places in the news media and so forth. It was a very, very fine experience for me because I got to see the plight of the minorities that I think so many of us don't quite realize. But I retired from Proving Ground from that job after nearly 7 years in it. and went to work for the state. The state I worked in the child abuse program. This was a matter of training again. We were training doctors and nurses on how to identify children that have been abused by their parents, and going out to the hospitals and to the schools and to the women's organizations and even into the workforce to some extent to tell people what to look for and how to report, the importance of reporting child abuse. And I remember something quite amusing, I think. I was telling someone that I was in child abuse and made the statement that I wondered how I ever got a job in child abuse because I'd never had any experience in it. And one of my children sitting by said, "Come on, Dad, you've had plenty of experience in child abuse." But I've had a pretty rounded work education. The one thing I didn't mention in talking about my life, though, that I have had in my mind, but my father was a very, and his parent and his forebears, and I mentioned they're giving ground for the for building a church, and they're supporting it and giving a cemetery, although it was for the community, it was to a large extent oriented around the fact that the Methodists didn't have a place to be buried like the Presbyterians did. But the role of the church in my family is a very strong one, and my father saw to it that we children went to school, to Sunday school regularly and to church. My father was a local preacher. By local preacher, we mean one of the lay people who is licensed to handle services for the church. He can't perform marriages, doesn't perform funerals, although I guess he could officiate a funeral. But my father was a local preacher, and I took the course and also became licensed, and I handled services in my church for an average, I guess, of once or twice a year, all of my many years in Aberdeen. But as Sunday school superintendent, off and on for 20 years, and a Sunday school teacher, and as one who has handled the services and worked closely with his minister on many church issues, and more recently, have I been a choir member? I've been there since 1970, to make it 16 years. I've gotten a great deal of pleasure out of and derived many benefits from my church. And I, talking about my life, I wanted to make a very strong statement concerning the value of that experience and what it has meant to me and to my family. We have five children, and although some of them aren't as much oriented to the church as I would like to see them, two of them in particular are extremely, extremely active in their church. Another thing in my family that has characterized my life, and I'd like to indicate the emphasis, I'd like to mention the impact that it's had, has been music. We've had many evenings around the piano singing songs. All of my children play some instrument. And as I mentioned, my father liked to play the cello, and I played his accompaniment, but we've had a great deal of pleasure out of that. All of the children play at least one instrument. And my eldest son plays for his church and for weddings, etc. Still, he gets a great deal of pleasure out of it. And also, my daughter plays violin, youngest daughter plays violin with the Susquehanna Symphony. So it's good that we had music, because it was a lot of very wonderful times that we've had with it. I think it opened the doors for some relationships, good relationships that my children have had in school and outside of school. And something that I would recommend to any parent that's looking for a way to hold his family together and to give them appreciation of one avenue that they might enjoy vocationally or avocationally. It's great. And we've gotten an awful lot of pleasure out of it. I've held a number of offices, like PTA president and assistant president and so forth, of the schools here in Aberdeen. It's kind of awkward because PTA was quite a problem for us with our children going to four different schools. Aberdeen had a lot of, instead of just the one school that I had. So we had children in at least three, and I think in one instance, four different schools. And it was difficult for me to play the role of PTA official when we were so thinly distributed. PTA night was pretty much the same in all the schools, and education week was pretty much all the same. So we found it rather difficult to get around to all the schools. But I thought that was kind of funny. People would say, well, why aren't you more active in PTA? And I say, well, I'm busy going to three others beside yours, and it's difficult for me to put on a strong role when I'm so thinly, and we're so thinly spread out. I've taken some offices, too, with the town. I was chairman of the Aberdeen Human Relations Commission, and Perry Monroe and I and some others were, Tom Coral and others, pretty active for a while when we were having some problems, civil rights problems, in that some of the black communities felt that the town was not providing the road service, repair service, and other things that black folks felt they were entitled to. Excuse me. Fact is, black folks were pretty right. And they were being shortchanged, and I was anxious to have a part in seeing if citizens of the community didn't get a little more of a fair hand from the town. I guess that pretty well covers the town and the church and the school.
Well, just one final question. Over the years, what are some of the changes that you've seen occurring in the county as well as Aberdeen?
I guess the growth of Aberdeen, all the shopping centers, you know, right downtown where the bank is on Howard Street and where the stoplight is on Route 40, that was the center of the town. If you came up by where the post office is to the Methodist Church, that, from the Methodist Church on down to the light, both sides of the street, was the town of Aberdeen. And a lot of those old businesses have disappeared. The bank, which is now where it always was, is quite a different building, and I'll talk a little bit about the changing buildings and business sites. The bank was about the same size as it is now, but when you walked in, the people who served the bank were in the middle of the building, and the tellers faced the outside of the building, so that you went along the periphery of the building in order to get your check cashed or whatever. Now it's quite different. There around the outside, you walk in the middle, and you'll find that true of almost all banks. But banks used to be, and the one in Aberdeen was just quite the opposite. As a boy, I was always, my father was one of the directors and vice president of the bank. And I can remember going in there and hearing the echoes of my voice reverberate around the bank building. My father
had to get after me a couple of times because I'd like to yell a little bit and then listen to my voice reverberate throughout the bank. Now they've changed that quite a bit. They put a second floor in there and they've moved their computers, a lot of their management people upstairs. And what you see at the down below is really half of the bank. The other half is upstairs. Right next to that was Bang's ice cream parlor and Dr. Cronin's dental office. And I can remember going in there. They had the old ice cream chairs there where you could sort of wire chairs very ornately turned. And the ice cream cones were 5 cents. Incidentally, as a little kid, I used to go in there and get an ice cream cone, and then my father would have to go around and pay for it after I'd gotten it. I didn't wait for him. People in the town knew me. My father had a lot of business in town. I'd go in there and get an ice cream cone either at Spang's or at Ivan's across the street. Ivan's had an ice cream parlor, too, and my father would have to go around and try to find out where I'd gotten my ice cream and then pay for it. But then there was Cookie's grocery store right alongside of Spang's. And a little further up the street was Smith's Garage and C.W. Baker Brokers. The Baker brothers had their own brokerage concern where they were selling the corn of their other Baker brothers and the family and anybody else that needed brokerage services for the Mitchells and the Osborns, who were also getting into the canning business. The post office was around on Route 40, and Adam Bonnet's newsstand. But of all those people and all of the stores, they've all changed. W.N. Adams is closed. The little movie that used to be there is closed. Gibson and Sutliff Clothing on the corner of Route 40 and Bel Air Avenue on the southwest corner, they're gone. The bank's about the only thing that's still there. And Edel's right next to it. Edel's is where Spang's and Dr. Cronin's dental office was that had the ice cream parlor. And then, of course, the many people, shopping centers, and the economic growth of town and not being able to see people that you know anymore. They're the biggest changes. Also, what I noticed, too, is my forebears had a lot of money. And when they got it, they helped. They really helped the town and anything that they could do, they wanted to do. And they did it almost anonymously. What I find now is that there are a lot of rich people that have been made wealthy by the community and by their businesses, but it's hard to find evidence of where they actually lay out some money or some effort for the community. It's pretty much a matter of, well, let the taxpayer do it or let the town worry about it or whatever. But the attitude I found that among my family of the way they like to help the community, I think, is a great loss. Not just my family, there are others, too, who were very, very helpful. And none of my comments are to suggest that my family were the only ones, but I do know them best. And I know that anything that they could do for their church or their community or their families, that they had the money and they were glad to give it. They all got along pretty well together, too, I think, in the town of Aberdeen. I think that people, I know my folks had families and friends that would, I think they'd do anything for one another. Everybody tended to stay pretty close to where they were born. My forebears, there were nine. My grandfather's family, there were four girls and five boys. With one exception, they all lived within 5 miles of one another. And if anybody needed any help, they were close enough and they could always go and give them a hand. And when I was in the child abuse program, I kept thinking of that, that here. Years ago, when grandmother, who usually lived at home with her children or grandchildren or great-grandfather, there wasn't a nursing home to farm them out to or to ship them off to. People stayed in their own homes. And that's the way Aberdeen was. But now, I have five children. One's in the Far East, one's in Ohio, and one's in Virginia, and one's in Baltimore, and one is in Edgewood. None are in Aberdeen. And all of the young mothers and fathers who are out doing their thing in the world to get a better job are all over the place. And grandmothers are working any place. They're working, and this is good. I'm not saying anything about the world today, but grandmother used to be at home minding a baby. Now she might be barreling down through Georgia with a load of produce on an 18-wheeler. Or she's a night watchman in the...
I guess the other elderly...
I was saying Aberdeen's like every other town, that people now have to go where the jobs are, and they used to be right around home. And grandmothers are not there. That's why we have so many child abuse. We found so much trouble in the child abuse area, and why so much more now than it used to be. Because grandmother's not there to help, mother's not there to help, dad's not there to help, or uncle or aunt. They're far away, and they're all doing their own thing. And they're realizing all of the great things of being one's own boss and doing one's own thing. And the way it used to be with all the live-in mothers, grandmothers, and so on, who were so much help in many, many, many ways to pass on the things they had learned from previous generations. That's not available anymore. It's not there. A lot of parents don't know what their kids are doing. When I was growing up, your dad and mother knew where you were and what you were doing, and if you, they didn't know, they'd find out. But that's where the big change is in Aberdeen. It's like every other city. The people move out and away. And right in Aberdeen, you live in an apartment house. You can live there 10 years without knowing, other than on a speaking level, who's living upstairs or downstairs or in an apartment next to you even. When I was growing up, that would never happen. You'd know who they were and where they came from and what their business was. And because a lot of people don't like to have people know their business, but there's a lot of benefits from the close association that the town of Aberdeen and this country used to know about.
Well, are there any other stories you might like to share from maybe your childhood or things you just might remember that we've already gone over or something?
As far as I know, that's pretty well. Pretty well covers it. I know after you leave, I'll think of some things I want to say. I always do, but I just think I've had a marvelous life here in Aberdeen, and that's one reason I stayed. Well, I had to look after my mother. I'm the oldest son, and I've looked after my mother. And I've stayed right here in Aberdeen when I had some pretty good chances to leave. I had a good chance to stay in the military after the war. I turned it down. I had a chance to go in both in the Navy or stay in the Army with a commission. I turned it down. I wanted a place where I could sink the roots pretty deeply, and my mother and father were still in Aberdeen, so I came back here and got a job. And I've stayed ever since, and I'm not sorry. But I've encouraged children to do just what they want to do. I think young folks have to decide for themselves. I've known a couple of instances where people have tried to tell their kids that they had to follow in the family business, or they had to do this because it was good or that. And we didn't follow that philosophy. We gave them all the help we could. And
kept telling them that they had to choose what they wanted to do for their lives. And it's worked out beautifully. We have our oldest son is getting his doctorate now in nuclear physics. He's got a real, real fine job with the Defense Nuclear Agency. My oldest daughter is a nurse, and she worked in the hospital with babies, and it's coming real handy with her now in her being a housewife and a good one. I have a third child who used to babysit for you a lot. That's Betsy. She got a degree in medical technology and worked in several hospitals, and now, having recently married and at age 32, is working toward a CPA. She wants to go into something else, and she's working on a research project for Johns Hopkins on malaria, where she is in Thailand. And Tom, our younger son, is a salesman. He's doing real well selling laboratory equipment to hospitals and businesses. And then we have a daughter who's a banker. But they're all doing something different. Every one of them has a little different interest, a little different job. And we've been blessed very much by